Right off Warnell Road, bright orange cones line the drive-thru at City Thrift, where workers help unload everything from clothes to furniture, even artwork. It takes two large trailers to hold all the donations. Over the lunch hour, Tony Worth pulls up in a convertible. She walks over with three bags of dishes.
Oh my goodness, I've got some old punch bowls and serving bowls that I've been carrying around for 10 years, have not used, and they should probably just go to someone who can really use them.
Tony doesn't donate anything with sentimental value, but she does feel good imagining that her old dishes might be useful to someone else.
I'm hoping that they'll go to a good home. I actually shop here myself. In fact, very often I've got a really bad habit of dropping something off in the back door and going in the front door and buying something else.
Tony doesn't seem overly attached, but she clearly likes stuff. And as soon as she gets rid of one thing, she replaces it with another. These days, we've got books on how to pare down, making the best seller list, probably for that very reason. But could there be deeper value in treating the things you acquire with dignity? Here to tell us more is KU psychology professor Omri Galath. Hi, Omri.
Hello.
In a nutshell, what's your thesis?
So what we're suggesting is that if you move a lot, if you move around, if you relocate for work, or if you move a lot as a kid, you develop this tendency to dispose of objects. And this is just a part of life, right? When you move, you can't always pick the stuff and take it with you, or you don't want to do that. But what happens is if you do it a lot, then this tendency to dispose of objects can also make you dispose of close relationships.
Could it be that it's not that the way that you're relating to stuff is necessarily translating to how you're relating to people, but that the same factor, that is that you're moving around a lot, is influencing both of those things?
Oh, absolutely. I think that, and it's not just the moving around. I mean, the moving around is just one of the factors. I think that we live in a society that highlights some things that are making us think in this way. So consumerism, capitalism, materialism, the idea of to move up, you need to move around. All of these things are make us, think about our close relationships this way. And this is not actually even my idea. It's a very old idea that Kurt Lewin, when he moved from Germany to the U.S., kind of came up with.
When was that?
That was back in the 30s of the previous century. So in 1936, 1933, he just moved to the U.S. and he made these observations about the fact that we have this freedom here to move, and that affects the way that we think about things, and that affects the relationship that we have.
Yeah, I mean, part of the American dream seems to be the ability to reinvent yourself and make your life what you want it to be from scratch. And this idea that you can just start all over, I mean, it's very deeply ingrained in our mindsets, I think. Do you think, for example, like when people, you mentioned materialism, consumerism, what about just that even, I mean, obviously long since the 1930s, but that we change jobs, I mean, that people don't stay in the same job for an entire career. I know every time I change jobs, I make new friends.
Right. So I think this is a great point. And actually, if you think about the school system, that was something very interesting for me. You know, I grew up in Israel and, I went to the same school, same class, same teacher for most of my school. And now I have my, two of my own kids and then they go to school here in Lawrence, Kansas. And they switch a classroom every year and they get a new teacher and a new set of potential friends, right? Or a new social network every year. And you're right. I see it with my students that they come in and stay here for 4 or 5 or 6 years and they know that they're going to move again because of the job market and so they're going to get one job here and then a different job there. And you're absolutely right. This is the society that we live in where we know that we're going to move a lot. And this is actually what we did in our studies. We asked people to think about moving and getting a new job that would get them relocated every couple of years or so, and it affected their perception of friendships and even their romantic partners.
Why look at stuff as sort of a barometer of all of these influences on us, these really widespread cultural tendencies, because I think people view their relationships with stuff as a very practical kind of thing, not so much something with great significance.
Right. I think there are different answers to that, and it's a very interesting point. So Lucas Kiefer, my collaborator and colleague here, actually have a different line of research on attachment to objects. So we both do attachment work. I do usually attachment to people, and he's focusing on attachment to objects, like your smartphone. So in his studies, he would take away the smartphone from students and then measure their level of anxiety, and students actually feel anxious when you take away their phones. So think about, you know, losing your phone or being without your phone for the day. It's anxiety provoking. And his claim in this line of research is that we develop attachment to objects because it can replace to some extent our malfunctioning attachment to people. So, you know, again, we're living in a very mobile world. We, you know, many things are virtual. We do things online. Think about dating, right? So one of the more common ways to date now, so I hear, is Tinder, right? And Tinder is offering you this opportunity to find a new partner with a slide of a finger. So that's, you know, again, this is done on a device. So I think there is a very strong connection between, you know, modern society and the devices that we have, and they're defining who we are and what we do.
How did you settle on exploring this very particular kind of triangle connecting mobility, that is the tendency to pick up and move with some regularity, with stuff and human relationships?
Well, I moved, and as I said, I grew up in Israel, and then I moved to California, and then I moved to here, to Kansas, and I saw what happened with my kids in school and how they moved every year, and that made me think about these processes. And I do close relationship. This is my main research area. I've been doing it for the last, you know, 20 years or so. And then I was interested to see the connection between moving and close relationships. And when I started reading the literature, I found these effects that are connected with objects. People like McDougall and others are talking about the preparation that one makes when they need to move, right? So the decision making process. Do I just move as myself and the other people around me, or do I take everything with me? We used to have a cat before we moved to the U.S. and one of our biggest decisions was, should we take the cat or not?
Did you do it?
We didn't do it. It's a lot of suffering for the animal when you move. And that's also, you know, again, one of the things that is so great about objects in a way, right? That they don't have feelings, so you can do all kinds of things as objects you can't do as people. But we don't always remember that, and this is what we're seeing in our study, that we treat the objects and the people in kind of the same way.
Or could the treatment of objects sort of reveal something about how we would like to treat people if not for their pesky emotions?
Yeah, exactly. This is something that you know, when I ask my students in my intimate relationship class, assume that you have a problem in your relationship, right? So you're dating someone and you guys have it going for a while, but now there is an issue and you have two options. One of them is to try and resolve the issue, maybe by going to therapy or talking about it. And the other one is just to find a new partner. What would you do? And many of them, to my surprise, say, we just move on. We just find the next person. And there is this belief that you can find a new partner and it would be easy to do that. And this is really interesting for me because I see the trends, the sociocultural trends that are happening, that more and more people are not getting married, more and more people are not finding a partner. The single demographic is the fastest growing group in the U.S. So this is interesting. We have these illusions about our ability to find an alternative partner or a perfect partner, whatever you want to call it. And then we just give up on something really good that we already have.
Tell me about your study. How did you look into this phenomenon in a really measurable, studyable way? Because it's wrapped up in so many really loosey-goosey aspects of our lives.
Right. So we tried to isolate things and really do it in baby steps and take small chunks. So the first study was super simple. We just looked at the way that people describe how they view objects and how they view people and we ask them about different types of objects and different types of relationships with people, so, you know, friendships and romantic relationships and so on. And we just wanted to see if these things go together. So that was our first assumption. This is kind of the first step in our model. And we did find that these things are correlated. So the way that you view object as disposable is also the way that you view people in your life.
Can you flesh that out? Because I think it could be really easy to misunderstand this. Like, Yeah, could you just give an example?
Sure, sure. So you know, imagine yourself completing this study and, you know, you're getting a set of questions and it says, you know, for each one of the things that you talk about as being important in your life, whether it's relationships or the object, tell us, you know, on a 1 to 7 scale, how likely you are to let go of it or dispose of it if, for example, it conflicted with your life goals, or if it was less popular or less liked, or if it was not fashionable anymore. You know, fashion is a big component here, or if you had to spend a lot of effort in maintaining it, right? So we ask them all kinds of questions, and so the scale has a set of questions in it where some obstacle is standing in the way of your relationship, either with your, you know, the other person or with an object, and you want to see how likely people are to give up, to let go, to dispose of the things. So basically, they completed the same questions about the objects and about the people, and then we found that they gave pretty much, you know, someone has the tendency to dispose. It's a generalized disposability, kind of generalized tendency. So that was the first study. The second study, we tried to connect that with the next step, which is moving around. So there is this concept of residential mobility. Basically, you know, we're asking people how many times you moved in your life. And we kind of kept it open so people can think about moving, you know, from house to house, from city to another, from one continent to another, and so on. And what we found was, a correlation, and there was a strong direct correlation between the number of moves and how you treat objects. So that was kind of along the lines that we expected. And then, again, the perceptions of objects was associated with the perception of people. So there is a kind of an indirect effect between moving a lot in your life and seeing your relationships as disposable, but there is not a direct effect. So the number of times that you moved is not associated with your tendency to think about people as disposable. So that was interesting for us. So this is why we decided to actually run two experiments and see exactly what makes people view objects and other relationships as disposable. So the first study, we took an existing manipulation, an existing experimental manipulation, where you ask people to imagine getting a new job. So just what you said at the beginning, you know, imagine that you got a new job and this is the job of your, you know, kind of dreams, exactly what you wanted. And there is one thing about it that you'll have to move every, you know, year or two for this job to actually happen. And it's interesting because, you know, one of my son's best friends until a few years ago was a kid that was his life. His dad was working in this big pharmaceutical company, being a manager, and he had to move every 2 years. So they kind of had a timer on their friendship, and it was interesting to see that. But anyways, so that was the study. We asked them to do that or to think about getting the job without having to move. And we found the effect that, again, priming people or manipulating people to think that they would have to move a lot made them look at objects as disposable, which in turn made them think about relationships as disposable. So still no direct effect. So then we get to the fourth study. And in the fourth study, we asked them to, again, do the same kind of like a thinking drill. But this time we asked them to think about the implications for their social network as well. And by doing that, we actually get the main effect on.
What do you mean by that? I mean, what do you mean by implications for their social network?
So you know, when we ask them to imagine new job, right? We told them that you know, they won't stay in touch with friends. They would move away from their network of colleagues. They would have to meet a new set of people every 2 years. So instead of just thinking about it as a geographical move, we actually wanted them to spend, you know, a couple of minutes when they think about that, on the human side of it.
So you really actively drew their attention to that.
Right.
I see.
Right. Because, you know, people are interesting. They have all kinds of defense mechanisms and ways to, you know, dispose in a way or deny what they don't want to think about. So if there's something that's threatening for you, you're not going to think about it, right? If losing the close people to you is threatening, you're going to focus on, yeah, I'm going to get more money and that's going to be a great job. And this is also interesting. You know, if you think about the U.S., there are many things that are happening around us that are trying to facilitate mobility, right? So you know, moving from one place to the other, the stores look the same, the restaurants look the same, the theaters look the same, right?
Phones go with us.
Yeah. So there are many things. And this is, again, this is something even before the mobile phone, if you think about the organization at Manzas, so this book from the 50s talking about the idea that the big organizations wanted their workers to be mobile, they were the ones who pushed for that. They were the ones who pushed for building things in the same way. So if you get out to the mall, it's going to be exactly the same.
But so, wait, what happened mm-hmm. when you told the people, okay, so you're going to have to move. You're going to have this great opportunity. Every 2 years you're relocating. And now I'm also drawing your attention to the fact that the implication is you're going to be leaving friends behind. You're going to be sort of extracting yourself from whatever social scene you're a part of.
Right, right. So when we did that, that was the first time that we actually found the direct effect. So that was the time where people actually said, yes, this is, you know, making us think as relationship partners being disposable. So that was the main effect that we were looking throughout these other studies. And we found that if you do this priming, you find this causal effect of moving a lot or being in a state of mind of moving a lot and the willingness to let go of close relationships. So if people know already, if I'm telling you that you're going to be moving in the next 10 years, every 2 years, you're going to maybe have some friendships, but they're going to be superficial and easy to dispose of.
So just thinking about the relationship with objects and their sort of disposability in our lives and how that relates to relationships with people, some aspects of this are unsurprising. I mean, I know that a lot of really affectionate, sentimental people with lifelong friendships also hold on to stuff like crazy, even finding ways to like enshrine it in their living spaces. But I also do feel like a cluttered environment can get in people's way and keep them from having like a comfortable space to enjoy one another's company. So I mean, I've actually read a theory that messy people may be subconsciously trying to create a barrier of stuff between themselves and other people. You know, do you see what I mean? That
yeah,
sometimes
no, absolutely,
stuff
absolutely.
And people are so different.
Yeah, and this is why I said before that this is complicated, because, you know, think about hoarding. Right, as psychologists, we're looking at this phenomenon where people are collecting objects, and this is obviously the extremity of that, where people are collecting all of these stuff, not letting go of anything, because they're so anxious about their environment, and actually, you know, going back to what you said about people having stuff in their living room, we have stuff in our living room. So despite the fact that we moved a lot in our lives, we have these magnetos, we have these memorabilia that we move with us. They're small enough that you know, we can carry them with us in a box or something, and then, you know, put them above the fireplace or something, and they would serve to make it feel, you know, as a part of us. So I definitely agree with you that people use objects in different ways for different things. I mean, heck, if you think about kids, you know, the teddy bear and the blankie, right? These kind of like transference objects that psychologists are talking about is
our best
way.
Friends, as kids call them.
Right, right, or imaginary friends, or, you know, sure. So we do that, and we need that, and this is a way for us to deal with the world and some of the inconsistencies in the world. Absolutely, but again, what our studies are showing is that if you develop this attitude where you care less about objects, where you see objects as disposable, and you're willing to move around and you know, let go of these objects, that's likely to proliferate and affect how you view your close relationships.
You know, I'm going to give you another example, because I know, I mean, I believe and trust your studies. I just feel like when I think about the people I've known in my life, I can identify some what I feel like are maybe exceptions, maybe not. I mean, I've known someone who I would say maybe fits the definition of a workaholic, who holds mm-hmm. on dearly to everything anyone's ever given to him, but has trouble making time for those people. I mean, of course, you could say that the relationships are sitting on a shelf, much mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. the things in the collection. But
right.
it does feel a little like a contradiction that this person really values stuff.
And I agree. And actually, so the studies that I told you about the attachment to objects are also kind of like sound contradicting to what we're finding here. But the idea is that it's not that you're not making connections. And it's not that you're not attached to people or to objects. You are. And it doesn't have to be exactly the same, right? Obviously, as you can see in the three studies that I told you about at the beginning, the main effect was only about the objects. We didn't find the main effect on the relationship. So it's not exactly the same. We're not saying people equal, you know, objects. But what we are saying is that if you look at the aggregated level, if you look at the statistics of the study, so, you know, taking 150 people, asking all of them about how they treat objects, and some of them going to be like your friend, some of them going to be like, you know, myself, some of them going to be, you know, different. So these are individual differences. But overall, if you look at the average, the people that are treating their objects as disposable are also the people that are treating people as disposable. And these people tend to be the ones who moved more. So, yes, obviously we can find examples of people that this is not the case for them. And this is not a super strong effect where, you know, we explain the entire variance. You know, it's rarely the case in psychology that you can actually explain, you know, everything in a phenomenon. But we are getting these effects. They are reliable. They are, you know, kind of like happening again and again throughout the four studies in the model. And again, our attempt here was, since this is the first time that anyone is talking about that in this kind of like empirical way, is to put it out there and say, go ahead and test it. Right. This is what we want to happen. This is how we work in the scientific community.
Call 816-235-2888 to tell your story. How do you relate to all those things that come into your life? Do they tend to take on sentimental value? If so, how do you manage that? And what does it say about you and maybe even your relationships? 816-235-2888. You know, people might hear this and assume that it all comes down to this decision, this moment of decision about whether to get rid of something or hang on to it. And you talked about that moment of decision being very heightened when you're moving. But it seems like a culture of disposability starts with how we acquire stuff to begin with. I mean, we get so much new stuff all the time that we have to get rid of things to function. If we acquired stuff and friendships with more care, maybe more of an eye toward permanence, is that really maybe the goal or the ideal?
Yeah. So, you know, this is going back to the kind of society that we want to be a part of, right? So when I said consumerism, you need to remember that our economy depends on consumerism. And you know, go back to Eisenhower or to Obama, and they were both talking about the need to buy. You know, there is a famous quote from Eisenhower that people talk to him about, you know, okay, so what do we need to do as consumers? He said, just buy. And he said, buy what? He said, buy anything. It doesn't matter what you buy as long as you buy and you move the wheels of the economy. So I think that, yes, we grow up and we live in a society where buying the newest, you know, kind of best thing is important. I mean, look at the devices that we're surrounded with. You always need to get the next, you know, iPhone or the next Samsung or what have you. Not because yours is broken, just because you got to get the new features. So I absolutely think that this is something that we are, you know, we're kind of being socialized into without even thinking about that. So you're right. It's not about the decision moment. It's how we grow up and how we're being raised. And ideally, you know, if you can get people to think about their relationships in a different way and maybe appreciate the effort a bit more, that would be better.
Let's talk about the human relationship piece of it a little more, because that's why this really matters. I mean, this might sound scandalous to ask, but is it all bad to treat human relationships as impermanent. There are cases where being able to cut ties with someone might be the most healthy thing to do. And being able to make new friends at any stage in life can be a real gift. I have a couple of really, really important, irreplaceable, lifelong friends, but I also have newer friendships, and I'm glad that as I changed and grew, I made room for those people in my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is you know, something that we thought about, because, you know, when we came into this research area, there was already the work on relational mobility. So this is the idea that you know, some societies affording you to make new friendships and some don't. So if you compare the US and Japan, for example, it's much easier to make new ties here in the US than in Japan. And this is great. This is great for people, you know, for immigrants like myself and others who are coming here. You can very quickly make new friendships. And this is what, you know, Kurt Levine said when he came here. You know, you very quickly, you kind of penetrate this initial level of familiarity and making these friendships. So this is definitely an advantage. But the question is, how deep does it get? So that's one thing. The other thing is that, you know, if you think about disposability, I agree that, you know, I agree with you that sometimes there are relationships, you know, like abusive relationships or relationships that are not, you know, good for your well-being that you should get rid of. No doubt. Same goes with objects, right? Obviously, you know, we want people to you know, be generous. You know, this is part of some of my other research about generosity. So I don't want people to stop giving away objects just because they're, you know, worried about what it might do to their relationships. But the concept of disposability or disposable people is something that's been studied a lot. And interestingly enough, with regard to immigrants and to minorities and temporary workers, right? And it's kind of relevant to what's going on right now with the elections. You know, the concept that there are some people who are disposable, you can just throw them back to where they came from and build a big wall. So looking at people as disposable overall, or in general, putting labels on people is not the right way to go with it.
When we come back, we'll take your calls about this topic, and we'll talk to a folk art collector with a different take on the usefulness and importance of everyday objects and what they might say about relationships. Call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. Central Standard will be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. Today, we're talking about whether there's a correlation between how you treat the things in your life and how the relationships with people are going. A KU psychology professor says there may be a lot more in common there than we like to think. Omri Galath, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
Call 816-235-2888 to tell us whether you're the kind of person who whittles down and upgrades when it comes to stuff, or if maybe you still have your baby blanket and use your grandmother's dishes. If you part with stuff, how do you do it? And if you hang on to things, how does that work in your life? 816-235-2888. Let's take some of our calls. We've got Bob on the line from Prairie Village. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. How about you?
Well, I'm having a great day. Every time I wake up alive, I'm surprised and very pleased.
Well, I'm glad about the pleased part. I'm not sure about surprise.
Well, thank you for having me on. No, I, as I told your producer, I'm a very, very lucky person because I am a recovering hoarder. I was the person who came into the belongings of both of my elderly parents who've since passed on, a couple of older aunts, and long story short, I equated, I don't know, everything to me was something I thought I should keep, hold on to, it might have some value, et cetera, et cetera. And thank God my beautiful fiance came into my life, and we sat down. It started with my storage unit, and it was a hellish day because I kind of wanted to keep everything. And she said, look, we got to put piles together, sell, donate, you know, keep whatever we need to do, but we need to pare this down. So I was finally able to do that and let some of that go. And I totally get the relationship thing because we all have that as well, I think, to where we equate certain friends of, well, I'm going to keep them because I think I might be able to use that at some point, or they need, I don't know. We put that in a pile and pretty soon we've got a clutter. And I think it happens with people. It happens with things. In my case, it happened with things to where I've been able to go totally minimalist. I still struggle with it.
It sounds like,
but it's getting.
But it sounds like also this stuff had to do with that it was connected to people who weren't around anymore, and
it
so
did, and
really
I felt
direct
like I,
relationship yeah. with people.
Exactly, and I felt like I was kind of the keeper of the flame, so to speak, because I'm kind of it. I mean, I've got three daughters and grandchildren now, but. I thought, my gosh, I've got to be the, you know, the keeper of the flame here and pass this on. I mean, I'm still the one who takes care of the graves of the family. It's almost like, you know, they're going to be forgotten. And my fiance, God bless her, would bring me around and say, what would your mother say about that? She'd say, why are you keeping that old dress of mine or whatever for someone else? Donate that to someone that can use that, Bob. And so that's what I'm trying to do. There's no
Thanks,
reason
Bob.
To keep things unless you're going to use them.
All right. Let's hear what Omri Gilath thinks about that.
I think it's a great story, and you know, last night I heard the Moth Hour, and there was a woman talking about her memories from being a little girl and seeing her house burn down, and you know, losing all the possessions that they had, and seeing her mom losing her wedding dress, and I think, you know, you got to remember, we're not talking about a one-time event. Try to imagine going through something like that, like, you know, taking care of your storage unit or your home again and again and again and again. And at some point, you know, because it's so painful, like Bob said, because it's so emotional, you're trying to protect yourself, and treating things as disposable is a great way to do it. You just don't get hurt by that.
Do you think that this idea that you can have clutter of people in your life, Bob mentioned that, and I think it's interesting. I mean, part of the problem with clutter is that, yes, you like the individual things you have, but when you have a lot of them, your ability to enjoy each of those things kind of decreases. Can you have that same phenomenon with human relationships?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, there are many studies about social networks and the size of social network. And you know, on the one hand, people talk about having usually 2 to 3 good friends. This is the average. So if you have that, this is what basically affecting your well-being. But then the networks or the circles are getting bigger and bigger, and you can think about hundreds of people on your Facebook. You know, it's like the guy that did the party in New York City and invited all of his, you know, gazillion Facebook friends, and no one showed up. So I think, you know, you can have a clutter, but for most people, the really important people, the best friend, you know, the romantic partner, the sibling, maybe, these are few and serving very specific functions in our lives.
Let's hear from Anne in Overland Park. Hi, Anne.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What can you share?
Well, I just had a question about if your speaker had done any studies with narcissistic personality disorder and their need for stuff and how that sometimes is more important to them than their relationships. My personal experience was I had a mother who had NPD, and she really cared much more about her stuff than her relationships and her children, and so that's a little bit different than what the research is that the speaker's been talking about earlier.
Yeah, let's...
And I just wondered if he had any comments on that.
Let's hear about it.
Yeah. So no, the quick answer is no. I haven't looked at that. This is more of clinical kind of work. But what we do in our work is we're looking at relationship styles or attachment styles, and one of them, the avoidance style, is very similar to the narcissistic personality disorder. In a way, these people tend to be very instrumental in their relationships. They tend to focus on things like work or objects. These are the people who are more likely to be attached to their cell phone than to real people because they're afraid of intimacy. They don't want to depend on others. They don't want to trust others. They have this almost compulsive self-reliance, as John Bowlby suggested. So these are people that would be similar to, excuse me, to the mother in this story where, you know, for them, this is a way to defend their sensitive self and to avoid future hurt feelings.
Let's switch gears just a little for a moment. I want to talk to Kelly Ludwig. She's a folk art collector who lives in Brookside, and she's the author of the book Detour Art. She maintains a blog by the same name. Hi, Kelly.
Hi.
So folk artists especially grassroots folk artists, tend to relate to stuff in a very particular way. Can you give some example of people you've worked with, met, collected, who have turned material objects they live with into art?
Right. A lot of the people I talk with and have visited collect stuff that almost becomes like natural raw materials for adding to creating artwork. They are very hesitant to throw anything away. A lot of it's from the Depression era. So when they have something, they feel they need to reuse it. It gives them an opportunity to be creative. And then their stuff gets transformed into what I think is works of art.
From what you know about them as people, just from your travels and interactions, how do you think that transforming stuff transforms them, like on a deeper human level?
Well, it's just that expression to have to create. I mean, I think that it serves as raw materials. A lot of these people, I was thinking about this, moving around, they don't really move and relocate from place to place. I mean,
that's not common among folk artists.
No, I haven't really found that. They're pretty rooted in their specific area, their homes, their land, and that also serves as kind of their palette, and it's their opportunity to use those resources to create their art.
In hearing the stories of folk artists, it seems to me that a lot of them get started either after an illness or in retirement or after the loss of a loved one. Do you think that the like transitional state of mind, if not moving physically, has something to do with the need to transform that stuff of daily life?
I think there's missionary Mary Proctor, who's down in Florida. When she lost her family to a major tragedy, there was a fire, she was very despondent. And literally, she felt that the Lord spoke to her about the door being the way. And so from that point on, she started using doors as her canvas for her artwork. And then she would relate stories that her grandmother had told her by using objects and applying them to these doors. There's one beautiful one about buttons. And then she created this whole great story, great piece of art out of the buttons that she had saved and collected, repeating the story of her grandmother who she had lost and using found objects that were around her home.
Omri, as a psychology expert, I mean, what do you hear in this?
I think, you know, this is again a way to cope. So if you're dealing with a loss, if you don't want to let go, kind of going back to what Bob said, if you're feeling the grieving is kind of overwhelming for you, taking it to the object level can be very useful. I mean, think about, you know, pictures in our life. Why do we hang to pictures so much? These are just you know, like two-dimensional representations of people, but we collect them. These are kind of memories that help us to hang on to moments in our lives that we'd like to remember and people that we like to embrace.
Do you think that transforming stuff is a way of hanging on to it or a different kind of disposing?
I don't think it's disposing at all. I think it is kind of like a way to hang on to it, and it is kind of a way to make it useful again. So it's kind of like, if you think about close relationships, one of the things that we study as relationship researchers is what makes, you know, some couples more successful than others. And it's in a way reinventing your relationship. It's putting hard work into it and making sure that you're not just letting go of things. And that's what makes it successful.
Kelly, I've seen your home, and you live in the middle of a carefully curated folk art collection.
Yes.
Where other people maybe have trinkets, you have art. The art is really the stuff of your life. Do you think the way you relate to that collection has any parallels in the rest of your life, particularly your human relationships?
Ooh, I know that the art that I have, a lot of it was collected on my travels and getting to have interactions with the artist. And maybe that's me bringing home a little piece of that experience.
And that relationship?
And that relationship, because a lot of these people, if they're still with us, I'm still in contact with. And I will try and go back to visit again. I've kind of, as you saw in my house, I've run out of room. And so I've now kind of switched my focus into collecting more experiences and documenting the lives of the artists that I've met, not so much bringing home objects from them, but memories and photos and things like that.
So, and maybe a pin on a map instead of a...
Yes, exactly.
Kelly Ludwig, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
KCUR Central Standard has to take just one last break this morning. You have a little time to get in on the conversation. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is Central Standard on KCUR. I'm here with Omri Giloth, a KU researcher who's found that when we treat our stuff as disposable and replaceable, our whole mindset might shift so far in that direction that we end up treating people in the same way. We've been hearing from callers who have a lot to say about this. Let's turn back to them now. We've got Linister and Volker on the line. Hi, Linister.
Yes, hello. I'm an artist, and I actually paint things. And when I was a kid, we lived in San Francisco, and I was handed a cardboard box. I packed my stuff in it. What I didn't get in that box got left behind. So I have a reverence for things, objects.
Because and you had to let go of them?
No, heck no. I keep them. I have them all stacked around the studio. It looks like junk to a lot of people, but it's props. And I do oil paintings of them. I like books, and I've got a human skull that I put in two or three paintings. And I accept it. Fascinating.
So you love stuff, but do you see that as something that corresponds to how you relate to people?
I don't think so. It's hard to say. I've never thought about that. I like young ladies, of course, and I don't have a permanent girlfriend right now. I wish I would, but no. But I easily identify with something that I paint. Books, I like a lot of books, and sometimes I put girls' names on the edge of the books, which I think is kind of amusing. And so, I paint realistic stuff.
Omri, what do you think about what you're hearing? You've already said there are, of course, individual exceptions to this correlation.
Right. So, maybe I missed that, but what I heard was that you used to live in San Francisco, and then you moved, and what didn't get in the box was left behind?
Yeah.
That's kind of fit with what we see in our study, where people, you know, that moved had to make these decisions and leave a lot of stuff behind. And then, it kind of depends. So how many times have you moved in your life?
24.
24 times?
Yes.
Yeah, interesting. And then you said that you don't have a stable relationship right now?
No, I really don't. We parted.
Right. So this is your N of one, Gina, in a way, you know, this moving around affecting, you know, this relationship view. But also, you know, it's interesting for me. So you're saying you're concerned about the fact that you don't have a relationship. Did you try to do anything about that? Did you try to?
Yes, I do. Yes, okay. I do. I meet with young ladies and see what happens.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think it's very interesting. I think that again, you know, we're talking not about a single person here or there, but we're talking about the more general phenomenon and where, you know, people move a lot like that. This is affecting the relationships and obviously affecting their well-being.
Well, thanks for that call, Linister. Let's hear from Marty in Kansas City. Hi, Marty.
Hey, Gina. I called in because I had a family that was generationally codependent. And they didn't have a lot of emotional, a checkbook to give out a lot of love. So my family expressed their love through allowing us to shop or giving us things. And so the things became a representation of love. So as I left the home, of course, I started loving myself by shopping. And I guess it's like anything else to me that's out of balance to that degree, you know, that you've got too many things. It obviously is a representation of something else. It's not actually acquiring the things, at least in my book. But I did find that things represented love because I had parents and grandparents that were so overwhelmed emotionally that they weren't able to express love very freely.
Yeah, let Omri tell us what he thinks about this. The idea that rather than being a similar kind of relationship, that the idea of an object being a stand-in for some other kind of expression of love.
Right. This is great. I mean, I think that this is a great example of where you're doing what you can, you're providing the care that you can, and sometimes it's instrumental care more than emotional care. So this is what I meant before about avoidant people. These are the people that feel that they're overwhelmed and don't know how to deal with the emotions. So what they do, they refer to this instrumental route, and you know, buying stuff to your loved ones is your way to express it. And then it kind of depends, you know. I think that we all, to a certain degree, like shopping, and this is going back to consumerism. So the fact that you enjoy shopping is probably strengthened by your relationship, your relationship in your childhood.
Omri, you know, what do you imagine researchers or possibly like practicing therapists doing with the kind of information you're providing? I mean, does this give some sort of insight into like anything from anxiety to depression, pretty pervasive conditions in our culture, or can asking questions about objects become a window into some of these bigger things?
Right. You know, well, I can only hope that people actually read the article and use it, right? And I know that, you know, many of my students that study close relationships want to, you know, become clinicians, and many of them do. So they're aware of that. But yeah, I think that even asking a simple questions about the amount of moves that you have as a child or growing up would be very informative and kind of get you to think about the kind of issues that people have. So you know, I hope that you know, people who are thinking about using it in a therapeutic kind of like context would think about residential mobility and think about the way that we treat objects and how that might affect our relationship with close others.
We have just a little time to talk with Cheryl in Kansas City, Kansas. Hi, Cheryl.
Hello.
Quickly tell us your story.
As a child, we moved every other year with my dad's job, so I don't have things from when I was a baby or anything like that. My mom and dad were married 22 years. They had a house fire, lost everything, and worked really hard to regain what they lost. They both passed away about 7-8 years ago, and I have their stuff. And it's a source of contingency with my new husband, because I have their stuff and I'm not willing to part with it, because they worked so hard for it. So I don't know exactly how I can resolve that and maintain my current relationship, because I have such an emotional tie to their things.
That is interesting. You know, Omri, thank you so much for sharing that really personal story. But Omri, you know, there's disposability in relationships, but then there's just like the life cycle, and that the relationships in our lives, for reasons beyond our control, come and go. And when we hold on to those past relationships, are we failing to make room for the new ones, much like with the stuff that goes with them?
Right. So this is kind of the question: can you love more than one person, or can you have enough, you know, room in your heart for more than one person? And usually the answer is yes. But to me it sounds, and again, I'm not a clinician, and I'm not giving here any kind of, you know, a therapeutic work or advice. But I'm just saying that it might be potentially some kind of unresolved issue or trauma, and it sounds, just from the couple of minutes that we heard, that you know, a lot of moving was involved and losing everything was involved. So obviously there are some leftovers, emotional leftovers that are affecting the relationship. And if her relationship is important for her, you know, you need to put some work into that and figure out how you can compromise and figure out a way to keep the memories and still move on and forward with your relationship.
I've you know, in the process of having to go through things and get rid of them, I think getting rid of things that are connected with people who are gone is one of the hardest things. I don't know if this is at all useful, but I've often just had to tell myself that the thing isn't going to bring back the person.
Right.
Well, Omri Galath with us from KU's psychology department, thanks so much for your time. This is fascinating research.
Thank you, and thanks so much for having me.
And thanks to the kind people at KPR for their help in making this morning's broadcast possible. You can listen back to this conversation at kcur.org. /Central Standard later today. Sign up for our podcast and you'll get all our content automatically on whatever device you prefer. It's super easy. Again, that's kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, our portrait session series turns the focus to Jonathan Justice, the man behind the Justice Drugstore in Smithville. Get to know his story tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Special thanks to Coy Duggar for going to the thrift store for us. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's a wrap. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.